Welcome aboard. We will be your guides during this magical journey into the movies. It's the perfect job for us because we love the movies. It's showtime. Ready when you are, CB.
Action.
Welcome to Monoreal Radio, episode number 283. I'm Sean.
And I'm Jackie.
And we are here this week to discuss the documentary Folklore, the Long Pond Studio Sessions. This is Taylor Swift is getting ready to kick off the second leg of her tour in Europe tonight, actually.
Yes, at the time of this recording, she will be in Paris with Paramore opening, I believe.
Well, congratulations, Paris. You finally got your Super Bowl. The NFL is thrilled for you. It is incredible, though. I mean, the circus, and I mean that in a good way, the circus that she brings to every city that she performs in. And what's really interesting is, at least, and I can only talk on my perspective, being on air at a top 40 station, which, by the way, I wasn't happy about. It was not a format that I liked. Still not really a format that I like, if I'm being honest. It wasn't one I was comfortable with. I wanted rock. I wanted sports, but I had to break in somewhere. So to break in on a format that I really didn't fit in well on, except I guess I sounded good enough, at a time where she was coming up, and seeing that a country artist was getting played on Top 40 at the time, very unique, because it was like, it was her, and it was like Carrie Underwood was bleeding over.
It's a great example, yeah.
You know, so it's just been crazy thinking back on how long I've, you know, been behind a microphone and seeing what her career has become.
Right. Well, that's sort of why we picked this for today, because I feel like everybody is sort of using Taylor Swift and the phenomenon that is the Eras Tour as sort of like a gimme, you know, and everybody's sort of trying to emulate her marketing now. You know, and that's not what we're doing here, because I was very concerned that this was going to be clickbaity. But you know, part of it for me was that for as long as we worked in radio, we had a very unique perspective because we watched her career from the ground up. I remember when we got Teardrops on My Guitar back in 2007, I believe her first single was Tim McGraw, and that was on that was released in 2006 on the country charts. All came from her debut self-titled album. But by the time they started playing her on our Top 40 station, she was starting to get a lot of notoriety for writing her own music. And I remember that that was really the push that we were making. And it was sort of like, don't mention the country thing, but definitely talk about how she's so young. She started at 14 writing her own music. And full disclosure, I didn't love Teardrops. You know, it was a good song. I appreciated the lyric, but at the time, you know, it's 2006. I had started my internship. I got hired to staff. I'm in college. So this was very high school to me. It felt very young and it just didn't hook me right away. What did hook me, believe it or not, was the country songs like Picture to Burn and Should Have Said No, because I was like, wow, she's really got a unique voice for that young and for writing her own stuff. And it was so different from anything else that was out at the time. So I definitely was on board from the beginning. I really appreciated the lyricism. I wouldn't call myself like a Swiftie. Well, no, that's not true, because I believe that everybody's a Swiftie and it's Taylor's world. We're just living in it. I just think that there's varying degrees of being a Swiftie. I'm not into all of the numbers and the theory and that's actually why I sort of dipped on Taylor for a while, because it just got to be too much. Oh my God, she's wearing red today and she sneezed. We're getting a new album. It was just too much, and I couldn't enjoy that actually, for as much as it became a communal experience, I think, and the fandom became communal, that's when it stopped being fun for me, believe it or not. But now, you know, with Midnights with Tortured Poets, I'm like back in full force, because she's just incredible. And I've really enjoyed watching the way that her writing has matured over the years.
So let me go ahead and just get this out of the way early on. I'm going to be the old man on his lawn. I like Taylor Swift. I think that she's exceptionally talented. I don't think that we should be celebrating artists who write their own music, because that used to be normal. It isn't anymore. Back in the day, before I got on commercial radio, I may have told this story once before on the show, but it's relative to this conversation. I interviewed Eddie Money, rest in peace. And in the interview, he had said to me, you know, we were just talking about his career, and Eddie wrote a lot of his own music. Two Tickets to Paradise and Baby Hold On to Me, you know, timeless, timeless songs. His biggest hit was Walk on Water. It was the song he disliked the most having to perform because he didn't write it. And it was his biggest hit on the charts. And I always kind of remembered that as like, you know, he got his royalty checks, he got the notoriety, but the song didn't mean as much to him because it wasn't uniquely his. Very few artists have anything that's uniquely theirs anymore. And I don't think we should be celebrating an artist who writes their own music when this used to be everybody.
You're saying it should sort of be like the golden standard. I think that if you're writing your own music, you should be championed, absolutely. But you're, in other words, saying that this shouldn't be such a novelty. It shouldn't be like blowing kids' minds that somebody is actually putting pen to paper and writing.
No, because every record that you used to buy would be 10 songs, and a majority, if not all of them, were written by the band that you were listening to.
Right.
It's sad that this is where we've gone in the industry.
Oh, no, and I've said that from the jump, that what I appreciate, I wish that I had Taylor to grow up on and look up to, because I do think that she's an amazing role model.
Agreed.
Rather than the Britney and Christina that I had to grow up on.
Yeah, and my thing is this, any like eye roll that I have, if I'm being honest with you, and this isn't going to make any friends, it's the Swifties. It's the Swifties that are too much for me. Now, mind you, folks, this is coming from somebody whose two favorite musical acts to this day are Kiss and Jimmy Buffett. You do not get two more franchises that have marketed and sold themselves more than Gene Simmons and Jimmy Buffett. But the thing is, it's not in the cult-like manner. All what you described, where it didn't, it's not fun and it's too much and it's overanalyzing and everything's a clue and everything's a, and we're all super sleuths. Like, it's it was never like that. I mean, Gene Simmons put his face on everything, but he wrote his own music, and they always just put on a consistent good show. They did what they set out to do. Jimmy Buffett the same way. It was never to the level that you're talking about. So I think that my any hesitation I have with getting fully on board with this has nothing to do with the artist and more to do with the insanity around the artist.
No, I agree. It's the marketing is brilliant. I appreciate that. I love the friendship bracelets and this girlhood culture that she's really brought forth again. Like, this is really the next generation's girl power that I got with the Spice Girls that we haven't seen in so long. But to your point, yes, it's the overanalyzing that's doing it. But I also appreciate that she is giving people something to look into and to not just take everything so much at face value.
Yes. Well, is this documentary exactly what we thought it would be? How enlightening is it? That, on top of many other things, is what we are here to discuss today.
This episode is sponsored by Fierce Fox Co., designers of handmade silkscreen shirts. Fierce Fox has a t-shirt, tank top, hoodie, or crew neck for every fandom. So whether it's the movies or theme parks, princesses or villains, the MCU or Star Wars, everyone will find something they love. The designs range from subtle quotes from our favorite films to iconic characters we can wear proudly in so many different styles, such as sketchbook and concert tees. Listeners of Monoreal Radio can get a 20% discount using the code Monoreal at checkout. Visit fiercefoxco.com to check out all of the collections.
So I want to get this out of the way off the rip.
Because no plot, by the way.
There's no plot, there's no story, right? Like, the story comes in the songs. This is not at all, I'd never seen it prior to sitting for this conversation. This is not at all what I thought this was going to be. What I thought this was going to be, the way that she starts talking about it was, holy smokes, we're going to see how a COVID album was put together in different locations, you know, digitally, and she's doing this in her house, and Jack Antonoff's in one place, and Aaron Dessner's, Dessner's in a different place, and we're going to put this whole thing together, and it's going to be this, like, incredible collaborative collaborative effort. And I thought this was an entire behind the scenes of making the album.
Like an entirely self-shot.
I'm thinking,
self-documented.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's going to be like Into the Unknown. It's going to be it's going to be Waking Sleeping Beauty for Swifties. Like, that's what I'm thinking this is going to be. And instead, what it is basically an unplugged album. You're basically attending an unplugged concert.
Right. Well, if you think about when they shot this, too, I mean, obviously, we don't need to rehash the timeline. Like, everything shut down March of 2020, and they were doing this by September. So really, people were only just starting to go back to work, and not even really in office yet. It was still very remote. Travel was still very limited. I really think the only reason, you know, they got to even do anything like this so soon was because, you know, they have access to private jets and, you know, it was a lot safer for them to travel. But they still had to do it for all intents and purposes in isolation. And it's really just the three of them there. Even the cameras, I think you had a couple of handhelds, but for the most part, it was just, you know, a camera on a robotic arm that's doing most of the legwork in the room with them so that you didn't have to have another person put at risk.
Yeah, I was also surprised to learn that this was the first time that she had an in-home studio. I thought that that was interesting. I figured most recording artists, especially one of her caliber and level of fame, would have had a home studio prior to this.
I'm glad that you bring that up because I really do like the introduction here. I like how it starts off with her talking straight to camera. I like this peek behind the scenes. What I really like too is that she mentions that, you know, she sort of had to actually commit to the idea of putting together an album because Jack Antonoff gets into it a little bit later of, you know, you can use this time where everybody was forced to shut down, put it to good use creatively,
right,
or you can just kind of let it take over you. And that was something that we were all faced with is, you know, not succumbing to having our everyday lives just ripped out right from under us.
Yeah.
So I think what's important here is that we know Taylor Swift writes a lot. We know that she takes a lot of inspiration from many different places. But I think the part that people may not realize is that when an artist is putting together an album, they might have 20 or 30 songs, which is actually what we got with Tortured Poets. But if you're cutting songs to make the album, you are taking everything that you've written and recorded and you're actually eliminating certain things that don't maybe feel cohesive, or maybe there is a theme that you want to put to this body of work and the songs don't necessarily fit. So you do have to sort of have it in your head that when you actually get to writing, you're writing with a purpose and there is an end game in mind. And it's not just, oh, she penned all of these songs and look at how they, you know, she just assembled them, hit record, and then it was out the door. No, there's a lot more thought that goes into it than that. And I appreciate that they sort of shone that spotlight on it. But to your point, to circle back to not having the home studio, I mean, we know that Taylor has multiple different homes. We know that she had the place in New York. We know that she lives in Nashville. We know that for a while she was on Rhode Island. So maybe, you know, that may just not have been her process where she'd rather physically go to a studio and like sort of separate the work from home. What I was kind of surprised by is that they talked about writing in isolation, like it was some kind of revelation, like they were the first people to do it. And I feel like that's what most artists, at least most of the ones that I've listened to, or most of the bands where you have multiple people writing songs, looking at you, Bon Jovi, like that is my favorite band. That's sort of always how they've done it, is like John would write, Richie, while he was still with the band, would write, and then they'd sort of put it all together when it was time to go into the studio. And I kind of thought, because she's a solo artist, that was sort of always what was going on, was she was just doing it on her own.
Yeah, I mean, again, this circles back around to the same conversation as before. I mean, Brian May and Freddie Mercury, they would just, the whole band would just lock themselves in isolation and they'd go away for a week or two and write an album. You know, like this is just, it's unique today, but it's not what the norm was. You know what I'm saying? Like
Red Hot Chili Peppers are a great example too. It was get away from the parties, get away from the drugs. We're going to put you in a house in isolation.
Yeah.
And you're going to bang out this album. But I'm not even talking about that kind of isolation where you're isolating an entire band from their life. I'm talking about Taylor just writing in solitude. I sort of thought that that's what was always happening. And then it was, okay, we're going to do an album. Let me take all these scribblings and then I'm going to get the melodies from Jack and then we're going to put this all together and that's what's going to be the album.
Well, I think that that's how it used to be and I don't think that's how it is anymore. I think you look at how many people are involved in a song. There are some songs with awful lyrics, by the way, and there will be 7 or 8 writers credited on it. I think that it's gotten too collaborative at this point. And I think that's something that I think is really interesting about this. It's a peek behind the curtain of a bygone era of what we should go back to, where you have 3 or 4 people that have writing credit on a song.
That's, I'm really glad that you said that, because I think that that's been in the back of my mind this entire time and I haven't really been able to articulate it, is that that's why this doesn't seem so special to me, is because this is what I've always known the recording process to be. What is really unconventional, though, is that she wrote this album the way that she wanted it, and there was no single. She knew that she might have a hard sell when it came time to pitch this to her label because they weren't going to have that radio hit. But that's where I was kind of like, what else does the label have going on at this point?
Nothing.
I'm sure they were more than happy that you used the time wisely and were able to even give them this album. And that's what I love that this album has become for a lot of the fans, is they really latched onto it. They championed it. And you didn't need that, you know, necessarily catchy, hooky radio song.
Yeah.
And they I think this is where the fans really appreciated her fully as an artist for what she's truly capable of.
Let's start talking about the songs here.
Yes.
We're gonna go track by track, starting with The One. I think that it's a heartfelt song. I think that it was very well written, and I love how it was shot. Like the cinematography, I think, in this entire documentary is outstanding.
I also was just completely taken aback by how fearless, no pun intended, she is to just be able to sit there with 2 other people in the room and just go. You know, that she doesn't have to be in a recording booth by herself. She can be in the same room and just have that confidence to just start singing. I mean, granted, one of these men is her best friend, but like, To me, I can't even wrap my mind around it. It doesn't matter if it's like in 10,000 people or 2 people. I just would not have that confidence to sit there and do that, especially when it's your own material.
Yeah.
I'd rather be like sitting there naked. I think I would feel less vulnerable than having to sing like this. So I just appreciate that so much about her. But as far as the song, to me, this is what I've always loved about Taylor. And I think that she does it at her, you know, this is her at her best, when she's able to just convey these feelings and emotions that seem so much more mature than her actual age. I mean, she's been doing that since she was 14, and just, we know that she's able to feel things really deep, but the way that she's able to distill it and make it relatable, I'm blown away every time. And without trying to get too much into her personal life, because I don't want that to turn into this, it's just sort of interesting what we know now, seeing, looking back at when these were recorded. This song sort of feels like she was already thinking what if at that point.
Yeah. And I think that that's a good transition into the second song, Cardigan, which it's a good burn song. I think it's really clever, really clever lyrics, actually. And like in retrospect now, it's like, who exactly were you burning when you wrote this?
This is known who this is about.
Is it? I don't know.
Well, here's the thing. I don't want to talk about her current personal life, and I don't want to speculate on the last long-term relationship. This is known about Jake Gyllenhaal. This is what made the fans hate him.
It's a little cultish, but okay.
I still like Jake Gyllenhaal.
So do I.
I'm not gonna, but that was the thing. She was young. He sort of led her on, and I think it's very much reflected in the lyrics all these years later. But that's the other thing, though. I'm glad this is coming up now, because I think that that's also sort of where I like a healthy separation from the Swifties, because she's an unbelievably talented writer. She's drawing from past experience and writing about it now. It doesn't mean that she's still harping on him. And it doesn't mean that every time she sits down to write a song, she's like, let me think of my ex. Okay, here we go. She's just still taking, you know, feelings, maybe not current feelings, but like a bird's eye view perspective of something that happened to her and looking at it, you know, like everybody does when they sort of look back on their life with a different retrospective, and you've gotten some distance from it, and your vision is 2020 looking backwards. And I would have said this differently, and I would have done this differently. You know, she's not sitting there with malintent going, you know what, Jake's due for a song.
Here's the thing. I want to comment on that before we move on to the next song here. Something, and I what I think this conversation in regards to this song really highlights is a very clear generation gap between people our age. You know, we're 38 years old. Not that old.
Newly 38. Thank you very much.
But the difference between somebody who's 38 who grew up coming out of the 80s, are, you know, the musical geniuses of our generation, were still writing and performing at the top of their game. Elton John, Billy Joel, Prince, Van Halen, so many, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Jackson Brown, real songwriters. I don't like Fleetwood Mac, but I'm going to put Stevie Nicks on the list, because even though I don't like Fleetwood Mac, I respect the fact that she's immensely talented. You know, Don Henley, Glenn Frey, all of them. And we saw that transition into, like, to your point, the Spice Girls, right? And what they brought.
Or and Britney, and things that were very much marketed. And in your, I'll even say it, the boy bands.
We saw the disintegration of the music industry into what has now become normal. A 14, 15-year-old, a 12-year-old that has discovered Taylor Swift, this is so unique to them, because so much, I have to try to say this in a way that I don't have to bleep myself. So much of what is played on the radio right now is pure crap. It's lyrics that mean nothing. It's lyrics for lyrics' sake. It's hooks for hooks' sake.
It's turn-up music.
It's garbage. It's absolute trash. 98% of the music that is released today is pure crap. So when they hear songs like this, they think she's so enlightened. And to an extent that she is. But they don't understand that this is what songwriting was. It was very personal. It was life experience. It was looking back. It was guessing on the future. I mean, this is what it always was. And when they react the way that they do, and what you're talking about, I think this is the best example of where that generation gap exists. And I think that this is where Taylor Swift really is, whether you love her or not. I think that this is where she is somebody that can save the music industry, but we need more people to start doing it the way that she's doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it needs to become that golden standard again. And I think, you know, what's weird is that with things now like TikTok, I think we could see that again, because we are seeing these independent artists just putting their material out there.
Right.
Or even look at, you know, like one of the biggest things and the one of the most fun things to follow during COVID was those girls writing the Bridgerton musical. I mean, a whole music, or the, didn't, wasn't there a Ratatouille one too?
There was a Ratatouille one.
And that was it. It was just people who knew how to play instruments, knew how to write songs, and they got together and they just did it. That's the hope. And I think that that's where the generations that are even older than us, why they are all so anti-Taylor Swift, because they're used to, that's what they grew up on, even more so than us. We've seen it both ways. But I think that, I feel like they should embrace her more for bringing this back.
Yeah.
Like, who cares that it's been done before? The important thing is that kids are finding it now.
Yes.
And they're appreciating it.
Yes. And I think, think about, one more thing, and then we're going to move on, I promise.
All right, old man, go ahead.
Take Me Home, Country Road. Why is that a hit right now? Why are 8-year-olds finding John Denver?
Probably TikTok.
Yes. But it's because they like this.
Yeah.
There is a hope in this younger generation that they are finding real music. There is no reason why that song should have a resurgence 50 years after it was written with a bunch of kids in the second grade. They're finding it because they love the music that Taylor Swift is putting out. They're recognizing what good music is. Kids are inquisitive, and they're going to find things on their own. TikTok had a big hand in that, I believe it, but like, there's a reason why you're starting to see this shift. I hope we keep seeing this shift.
Absolutely.
Let's move on to the last great American dynasty here. She talks about how she still loves country music, and I believe that she does. And I really like this song. I think it's probably the best song on the album. I mean, not that I've listened to it that many times, but I feel like this is the one that I kind of gravitate to, and I wish that she would do more like this. Admittedly, I did listen to the new album. The first two songs to me sound like Talking Heads, and I thought I was really going to get into it, and then I just disliked it from there on out. I wish that she would write more like this. Everybody kind of has that concept album, but I feel like her last few have been sort of concept albums. That's just my personal taste in music. I would like to see her get closer to the country again.
Well, that's sort of why this album was such a big deal, because, and she does say as much, this is the first time she didn't really do something autobiographical, and she wrote it allegedly about other people. What we're coming to see now is that this was autobiographical. She was just sort of silenced from actually making it personal. So she sort of assigned these characters to everything, like Betty and Rebecca Harkness, who this song is about, because I don't know if you know this. She the home that she had in Rhode Island, she purchased it from Rebecca Harkness, who was like a socialite. You know, it's like that quote that, women who are quiet and well-behaved seldom make history. I happen to love that quote. And to me, that's what this song embodies. And then, you know, by the time you get to the end of the song, she's talking about Rebecca Harkness shaking things up in this little, quiet town. And that's essentially what she did, because the locals didn't like when she moved there. But I love the song. I think it's super catchy. And I love the lyric, "I had a marvelous time ruining everything."
Yeah. I'm going to touch on that in a little while, because I have a note on that specifically. Exile. It was wild how they bring in a fourth person through what I would have to imagine was probably an ISDN line, because you kind of need it to be immediate.
And you both need to hear the metronome click. Otherwise, you're never going to pull this off. Like, you can't do this through Skype with a delay.
No. ISDN was how we used to do live broadcasts back in the day. And it used to be very expensive. $5 a minute it used to cost to run through an ISDN line.
Oof.
Yeah.
I think it's similar to the way that she show the setup in the beginning where she says, Jack, are you there, into the microphone, and we can't hear him. She can in her headphones, but you're in real time together. There's no video delay. There's no lag.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else on the song itself?
Oh, gosh, yeah. This is my favorite song on the album. I love the lyrics. I love the melody. And I think it is kind of ironic how she wrote this song, which sounds like a breakup song, with William Bowery, who we've come to know is Joe Alwyn.
My Tears Ricochet. It's a good song, if I'm being honest with you. This is where it starts to get a little repetitive. I didn't feel like this song was terribly unique. My biggest takeaway from this was I liked the insight of having to pick track five. I like how she thought creatively, because you start getting into that 5, 6, 7 and you don't really have your singles there. You start getting into what kids, when there were records and cassette tapes, used to be called B-sides, because you had your hits on the A-side and then you'd flip to the B-side. And it was very rare that you'd have a B-side hit. Kiss did it. Beth was a B-side hit on the Destroyer album, but they kind of did that as a joke because they thought, how funny is it that they put this ballad as a B-side? Let's turn the record over and make a hit out of it. It was kind of like tongue-in-cheek.
Well, I think you should dive into that a little bit more, what the B-side is and why it was considered a B-side, because it's like our generation will know, you know, putting the second VHS tape in for Titanic because it was too long, but a lot of people aren't going to realize flipping the record, flipping the cassette. A lot of people didn't take the time to bother to do that
because it was filler.
So your B-side was you front-loaded your hits basically for the people that weren't going to bother to listen to the back end of your album.
Right.
Because you had to physically do something to hear those songs.
Correct. And you were already spending the money to record and produce the tape or the record. So you kind of did just put filler in. And you know, now you have these bands in the digital age where things turn to CDs or now even with downloads, you have these 5-song EPs because they don't have to put filler in anymore because there's no such thing as a B-side. But they still think about B-sides, and you don't get B-sides anymore because they are kind of just filler. A lot of times it's songs that they had written for a prior album, it got cut and they already recorded it or they already have it written, so they need 2 more songs to round out the album because they were physically spending the money to print the physical media. And they would just take a song that was cut from something else and then they would reuse it.
I'm really glad that you bring that up, though, because this is another thing that all of the Swifties think is sort of a revelation for Taylor, but it is something that is sort of music industry standard. You know that Taylor is very big with her numbers. Track 5 is usually like her favorite song or like her biggest statement song. So that's why there is such an emphasis when Jack says, oh, this is your track 5 song. But to your point, I think there is a little bit of history there as far as, you know, that's the cutoff before you go to the B-side. I do think that you're missing a very big piece of this. Actually, I think a lot of people are missing this because I don't know why we don't talk about this more. The song is called My Tears Ricochet. Is that not a callback to Teardrops on My Guitar, her first really big breakout single? I mean, if you're not counting Tim McGraw on the country charts, we're talking about this was her breakout debut, Hi, I'm Taylor Swift song. And if you really listen to the lyrics, I believe that this is about her former label. And what impresses me about this song is that even about, you know, she's speaking about such a personal experience because it's something that happened to her with her music being stolen. She's able to distill it and distill this emotion into an experience that everyone can relate to. So I actually think it's a very important song, and I think there's a lot there.
And by the way, just speaking on that before we move on to the next song, she is so massive at this point that I believe that she is going to, when she contractually fills her obligation, I think she's going to break away from labels completely. I think she's going to self-distribute everything. I think she's going to self-market everything. I think she's going to book her own concerts. She doesn't need the support of a label at this point. She may even start her own. She'll do the Jimmy Buffett thing. She'll start her own Mailboat Records sort of deal and bring others like her on. That's what I honestly think she will eventually do.
Well, she's currently, Big Machine is what stole the music from her. And then she went to Republic. But I'm not sure if she does have a piece of that already.
Well, if she doesn't, she will eventually.
Yeah.
Mirror Ball is the next song here. I think lyrically it's very smart. In retrospect, it captured living in the pandemic so well because of the self-reflection. That's mm-hmm. literally what it is, right? And you kind of sit there and you think back in isolation, because other than day drink, we didn't do anything. So you just kind of sat there, and sometimes the day drinking led to the self-reflection, right? But I think that in retrospect, it's one that captures that period in time very well, a period in time that I refuse to ever live through again, regardless of what happens next.
I think that this is her most interesting inspiration for a song, where she's describing seeing this empty bar setting and, you know, it's just sort of the mirror ball that's hanging there. I love how she uses that as a metaphor for celebrity. You know, not the first person to do it, but she does it in a way where it just sort of gives us a little bit of insight as to how she's feeling without complaining about it. Like, you had a song, I remember when Britney Spears released Lucky, not that she wrote it, but then they did this whole music video about how she's crying when she's alone. And it's like, then don't do it. You can step away. Like, it just seems so ungrateful. And I appreciate how Taylor was able to convey those same sort of feelings without dissing the people that put her there. And again, she somehow manages to make it relatable to the everyday person talking about, I really love the setup of this song too, how she's talking about how everyone is sort of duplicitous in their very nature, because you are sort of different versions of yourself to different people, and you're one to your family, and you're one to your coworkers, and one to your partner. And I love that she was able to just round that out in a neat little bow and convey all of these feelings into one singular arc. So I really appreciate the lyrics. The only thing is, like, for as much as I love it in concept, I can't get into the song the way that I want to. I feel like if this was a glitter gel pen song, if you will, you have been explained this, Sean, you know the difference between the glitter gel pens and the fountain pens and the quill songs. I have broken that down for him at the very least when Tortured Poets came out. But I feel like this could have been very cool, really embracing that mirror ball, that disco ball, and sort of having it tongue in cheek, almost like "But Daddy, I Love Him,"
mm-hmm.
or I'm sorry, not "But Daddy, I Love Him." I Can Do It with a Broken Heart, where you have those really deep lyrics and those sort of sad lyrics juxtaposed against an up tempo song. I think that could have been really cool. But she gave it to us eventually on Tortured Poets.
Yeah. And I want to comment on one thing before we move on here, the Britney Spears thing specifically, when releasing Lucky. The funniest part about that is that it is a complete contradiction of itself, because as you pointed out, she didn't write the song. The people who put her in that position previously are the same people, the same kinds of people that wrote an FU song about themselves and laughed all the way to the bank when people bought it and put money in their pocket. The music industry, ladies and gentlemen. Let's move on and talk about Seven.
Track Seven, which is also named Seven, yes.
I gotta be honest. It's just there. This just sounds like every other song on this album. I could not tell you this song from any other song.
Oh, I like it. I like the melody. And I like that, similarly to Mirror Ball, I think this could be about the media or even the fans as a gentle reminder that she's human and treat her as such.
August. This, I think, was the most fun I had watching this entire documentary, because I loved watching her sort of compose, work with her hands. This seems like it was the most into it that she was. I think that this was the most into it she was of any other song that she was recording. Just the way that she moved with it. And I think that it was one of the better songs on the album.
I think this is probably commercially the biggest song off of this album. I mean, obviously, I remember it being very big on TikTok in the month of August. You know, they used that little clip, August slipped away like a bottle of wine. You know, everybody's posting their summer memories. So to me, if anything, this was the quote unquote radio hit. But I do love the song. And to me, this proves what a talented writer she is, that it started with something that she jotted down in her phone, "Meet Me Behind the Mall." And it just sort of took on this whole other meaning, because "Meet Me Behind the Mall," you know, that's sort of like a high school thing. And the lyrics go far beyond that.
Yeah. And hopefully that generation and future generations will have a mall to meet at. I don't think it is very likely that you will, unfortunately.
You are just a barrel of fun on this episode, old man.
I mean, no. Malls are getting demolished and replaced with condos because people just do all their shopping online. It infuriates me when I go to a store to get something specific that I need in that moment to be told, well, you can order it online and have it in 4 days.
What was Hannah Montana fighting for?
Mm-hmm. Well, she was fighting for a mall at one point. This is me trying. In retrospect, this is affecting people now. And Fox 35 had a really interesting segment on it. What we've seen now in 2024, May of 2024, at the time of this recording, you are a little over exactly 4 years past the lockdown happening. The anxiety, the depression, the substance addiction, the alcohol abuse that people are starting to really address now, because these were things that they had started doing in lockdown. And a lot of people haven't recovered well,
right,
mentally, physically, or emotionally going back out into the world. So I think that it's so interesting now that 4 years later we have this song to kind of reflect on, for a lack of a better term.
I really like the way that they set this song up, especially, you know, when they're talking about how if it is someone that is dealing with depression, just showing up and trying to be present is such an act of trying. So I really like, you know, the discussion that they had where the inspiration from the song came. I think that that's, again, something it is relatable to everyone. But looking back at it now and looking at the specifics, it's very interesting that you bring up the addiction, because that is something that sort of came to light in Tortured Poets. I do think that the first verse is about Joe. The second verse is about her. And the song is for everyone that feels like their best isn't good enough.
Illicit Affairs. This is where I have my note about, quote unquote, not autobiographical.
Oh my, right, yeah, same note.
Yeah, it was like, give me a break. Yes, it is. It's not a bad song. Again, it's more of the same. That's what I got. It's, to me, it's more of the same.
Yeah, I mean, you took my note, so I don't have too much more to add to that.
How do you feel about Invisible String? Because to me, this is the most filler song on the album.
I mean, I love the idea of the fate behind it. And I love how she wrote to that. But it's sort of sad knowing how the relationship played out, because I feel like she truly believed that this was her end game.
Mm-hmm. Mad Woman. I think that this is a really well-written song. I like the call to action.
Mm-hmm.
I like her personal connection to it. I think it's strong. It's a strong track.
I absolutely love this song. I love the female rage behind it. I love where she's setting up her inspiration, where she says that a lot of the time, it's not necessarily what a woman does. it's how they respond to it that people get offended by. And it's just, you had the audacity to even say something that really is what makes people tear them down. The only thing is that I wish the music matched the lyric as far as that, like, girl power yes. anthem. I wish that this was maybe more in, like, her Reputation era, like a Bad Blood or like a Trouble, where you've got a little bit more punchy guitar in it. And I wish that it was a little bit more of a rocked out track. I do like it, but this is one. And again, I mean, I have not been to the Eras Tour. I haven't even watched it on Disney Plus yet. But, like, I feel like if she ever wanted to really shake things up with a live performance, she could do this as a big rock number and flip it on its head and give it, like, that real rage that you want.
Epiphany. I love the personal connection to her grandfather.
Oh,
that
my
served.
Gosh.
And I think what's unique about this is, especially in country, and they're all good songs. I'm not trying to dump on them. But a lot of the time you hear about somebody singing about their father who served or their grandfather who served. And they talk about the battle scars. But I did it for my family and my freedom, all of which is true. And certainly I have a great amount of respect for those who have served and fought for our freedom. The only other song that to me is as unique as this when telling a personal connection and sort of telling it in a different way is Still in Saigon by the Charlie Daniels Band, which was a song that was very ahead of its time. Written, I believe that song was written in the 80s. Talking about PTSD before anybody was really talking about veteran PTSD.
Wow.
It's a wonderful song, and I implore anybody to go listen to it. And I kind of feel the same way when it came to this. You're telling the same tale that we've heard so many times, but in your own way, and I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, I feel like this is the song that I personally connect with the most because, you know, when they're setting it up and she talks about, you know, that your grandfather fought. In my case, my grandfather was in Korea and they never want to talk about it. And I think it's very, very hard because you had to do something that you were asked to do. You had to carry out orders. And you probably did some unspeakable things that you wouldn't do otherwise. And you are trying for the rest of your life to rationalize that by looking at the people that you love and knowing that on some level you had to do it for them. And I'm not even going to pretend to know what that must be like. I cannot even imagine, but I do relate to it in the sense of, like, unless they are willing to talk about it, you don't ask. And
yeah.
It just sort of, unfortunately, has to remain a mystery. And the way that she was able to tie that to what we were at the time of the recording dealing with present day about what the first responders and, you know, the doctors, the nurses, what they're all dealing with on the front lines. You know, you can only imagine what they've seen and that they may not be willing to share all of the horror stories. And I think that that's something, you know, in the coming years we might see trickle out little by little, but I really think that we have to get farther removed from it to really get that full picture.
Yeah, these are all people that need to be taken care of. Both of my grandfathers served in Korea. I had friends in high school that went on to serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you're right, some people are openly happy to tell you about their... My grandfather will happily tell you about his Purple Heart. Other people, they won't tell you anything, and that's their right. But them, the first responders, they do need to be taken care of for sure. Moving on, Betty, this to me, like, of all of the, like, quote unquote old school Taylor Swift songs, thinking back to when she was first coming on the scene and when we were playing her on Top 40. Of course, we later ruined her Top 40 hits by actually putting Top 40 beats underneath, and it completely took a beautiful song and turned it to crap. But this, to me, is the most old-school Taylor Swift that we hear on this album.
See, that's interesting because she co-wrote this with William Bowery, and they wrote an apology song, like, together. So I think that's kind of interesting knowing what we know now. I liked when I didn't know that. I liked thinking about the song more in terms of the character. You know where the name Betty comes from, right?
I don't know.
She's very good friends with Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively, and that's one of their kids.
Oh, okay.
So it's named after her. Not about her, but named after.
Peace. This is another song that my note here is that it's more post-pandemic connection. I mean, that's really all that I have. 4 years later, I think the song is very reflective, and you can tell right away that this is a song that was written in quarantine.
See, that's interesting because I like how she sets it up because I think it's very personal. And with any relationship that she's gotten into, it's that she tries so hard to, there's so many things that are beyond her control. She's not going to be able to control the paparazzi taking pictures, and she's not going to be able to control the fandom necessarily, but she tries to control the quiet moments in between and, you know, questioning, is that enough or is it one day going to become too much? And, you know, now we've seen the answer to that because it clearly was too much. But I think that even with it being so personal, she still does make it relatable because any relationship deals with these type of issues. And, you know, it's whether or not you can weather the storm and handle the chaos that life throws at you together and make sure that it doesn't tear you apart.
Let's see here. Hoax. So here's my thing with Hoax. I think that the lyrics are very good. I think the lyrics are very clever, which is sort of what she's known for at this point, right? But I can't differentiate this song from any other song on this album. This is another one that to me is sort of just much of the same, if I'm being honest with you.
Which is interesting because they put such an emphasis on it being the last track before they said, oh, wait, hey, we have a bonus track. To me, I was listening to it, and you're right. I hadn't really given it too much thought, but when I was listening to the lyrics, it sort of made it sound like she took someone back after they had cheated. So I'm not saying that that was the relationship at the time, but it just wasn't what I was expecting. It wasn't the note that I was expecting the album to end on.
The lakes. I'm just going to call this right now. I said it before that I think eventually she's going to, if she doesn't already own the label, she's going to go label-less. She's going to do everything on her own. I'll go so far as to say that, frankly, do I think that she ends up with Travis Kelce long-term? I honestly believe that she does.
I do too.
I think that, you know, he can be a bit of a clown. He's imperfect, right? But he's not the same way. He's not the same clown in the NFL the way that like Gronkowski was, right? Where Gronk is sort of just like that eligible bachelor all the time, party boy, but you love him because he's a big personality and he's good on television. I think Travis Kelce is a lot more grounded. With that being said, I 100% believe she's going to go off the grid and we're not going to see her for years. I think she's going to do the Garth Brooks thing, what he did with Trisha Yearwood. He's in the prime of his career and then he's gone and you don't see him for 10 or 15 years. And all of a sudden, he comes back once his kids are grown and he's touring again. That is what I think she's going to eventually do. And I think that's kind of what she's telling you in this song.
This is what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to speculate, but being that the song is on the album, I agree with what you're saying, but I think she was ready to do it here. They're talking about going off to this like artist collective space and shutting the world out. And I think, especially knowing what we know now, I think that's where the most heartbreak comes from, because she was ready to do it at this point. At the time, she still would have been at the peak of her career and ready to walk away and settle down. And I think that that's where, or why we get tortured poets, because she really was all in. And I think that that's, I would agree with you. I think that that's what's going to happen now. I think it's a well-deserved break for her. You know, she's 34. She's just done the biggest tour of her career. And I think that the level she's attained is going to be very, very hard to sustain. So I, you know, if this is all leading to a break, and as much as I don't want to necessarily subscribe to the theory, I do actually think that the 3-2-1 theory carries a lot of water. I think that Midnight's Tortured Poets and one other album are going to be sort of this trilogy. I think we're finally going to get Karma, and then I think that she's going to take the break for a while.
Yeah, and being a billionaire doesn't help, or it doesn't hurt, I should say, which obviously she hit that status, so she could be done for life. I think she's going to take a very long break. I think you are not going to see or hear from her for years.
Well, her whole thing, and she said it in multiple interviews.
Now, mind you, folks, I don't know if you figured this out yet. I don't really know much about her. This is just me speculating based on what I'm hearing in music.
What Sean knows is from TikTok videos that I've sent him where it's a little bit of the fan theory, but it's the marketing behind it that I really appreciate. And that's really the most that you've gotten. But why I believe that she's taking a break, other than the fact that she's earned it, is because she has said on countless occasions, I don't want to overstay my welcome. And that's really what happens when you see these artists where it's too much too soon and they burn out. She's consistently released a record every 2 years, except for Reputation. I think that one came after 3 years. Because she was quiet for a while after the Kim and Kanye thing, and then she rebranded herself. But ever since then, it's one every 2 years again. And, you know, I think that she's got to give herself a break just to settle down and have a life a little bit. And I think, unfortunately, the public is saying that they need a break. Not the diehard fans, because they're never going to have enough, but I just don't want her to keep subjecting herself to ridicule for people that have negative things to say about her.
The same people that embraced Beatlemania, go figure, are the same ones that are sick and tired of seeing her on TV. Final thoughts on Folklore here. I'll go first because I'm quick. It's not what I expected it to be. I didn't really want to sit and watch an unplugged concert, but I thought that the first 15 minutes of it were very interesting. Yeah, and everything I said before about the music industry. She's immensely talented, no doubt about it. But she can no longer be the normal. She can no longer be the outlier. We need her to start being the normal. We need this to come back. I don't think it is ever going to happen, if I'm being honest with you. But that's what I would like to see.
I would agree. I really like the look at the making of this album, and I like the insight into her songwriting process. But I do think that the better documentary, if you're looking for a bird's eye view of her life, is Miss Americana, which is, when I saw it, it was on Netflix. I'm not sure if at the time of this recording it's still there, but I think that that's the better artist perspective documentary. But I like this for what it is, and I'm really hoping that she does do something like this with Tortured Poets, because there's a lot there. There's some really deep lyrics. I think it's her best album. Is it my favorite? No. If you're interested in knowing what that is, DM us. I'm happy to talk about it. But I would really like to see the wheels turning into making Tortured Poets.
We are interested in hearing what you have to say about Folklore, the Long Pond studio sessions. You can let us know on any of the social media platforms at Monoreal Radio, or you can shoot us an email, monorealradio@gmail.com. Join that conversation. News of the week is coming up, but first, a quick break.
News of the Week is proudly sponsored by KMV Travel. KMV Travel is a boutique travel agency that helps families plan personalized vacations and create unforgettable memories on land and at sea. KMV Travel specializes in Disney destinations, family theme parks, and most major cruise lines, providing unmatched service from start to finish with the belief that vacations are an important part of life. KMV Travel will help you and your family experience new places, learn about other cultures, relax, and reconnect with those who mean most. KMV Travel will guide you from booking to bon voyage, ensuring you have the tools you need to enjoy each moment of your vacation at no extra cost to you. Visit kmvtravel.com to connect with an expert travel advisor and start planning your getaway now.
We are halfway to Halloween, and as expected, we got both Disneyland and Walt Disney World announcements when it comes to Halloween festivities.
Finally. I thought we were going to be halfway to Christmas before this finally dropped.
Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween Party is returning to Walt Disney World starting on August 9th.
For a lot of nights. There are quite a few to choose from.
And if you are interested in going, hotel guests, if you have an existing Walt Disney World reservation, you can buy your tickets now. General on sale will be on May the 15th. They are promising new costumes for Mickey and Minnie and more villains in the park.
I think that might, well, no, they can't wait until D23 to announce more villains, but I'm wondering if this is a little market test.
Could be. For the Beyond Big Thunder project, it certainly could be.
Or Fifth Gate.
Yep. And Oogie Boogie Bash is coming back on August the 23rd. It's so interesting that Oogie Boogie Bash is starting 2 weeks after Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween Party is starting. I think Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween Party, it's starting so early this year. I mean, they're getting a jump on everybody in Orlando, but like by a substantial margin.
I mean, last year, I believe it started on or around the 15th, so it started mid-August, but I don't think that you can do it that early with Disneyland, and this is, you know, besides kids going back to school and working with that schedule, I think it's simply for Haunted Mansion Holiday. I don't think that you can turn that over that fast.
Yeah, perhaps you can't. And some streaming news here. Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max are joining together as a trio bundle package. Disney and Warner Discovery have come to an agreement. This was just a few hours ago, and it was through Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, so you know it's true.
I haven't even seen it yet, honestly.
It's coming this summer. No date, no pricing. But now this is the second agreement that Disney has entered into, because we know that they're doing that sports bundle with Fox, with ESPN. I'm going to assume that this is going to start in the $40 range. But both Discovery and Disney doing this because Max has so much and Disney has so much. They're typically rivals, but they're putting it together because both of them are seeing dips in subscribers.
God, I have so many feelings about this. You blindsided me with this. I was working. I had no idea that this was even happening. I mean, the TV fan in me is excited for how much of the catalog we're going to have opened up, though I will still die on the hill of I don't think a child should be able to open up a platform and now be able to watch The Sopranos and Sex and the City. The consumer in me is very concerned. I mean, I think if what you're saying is accurate, I think $40 is an awfully big price tag for that much. But I mean, it's like, how much more of this are they going to do though?
I mean,
before a monopoly is formed, you can't do this. This happened in the 20s and it fell apart.
Yeah, well, that's kind of in the direction that it's heading in. I mean, yeah, I'm not paying for it. I'm sticking with what we got.
No, for sure. But I'm just saying this is not sustainable anymore. And I feel like everything is going to collapse even worse than it did last year with the writer's strike. And, you know, even worse than it did after the pandemic where everybody was afraid of all the subscriptions being canceled. I think we're going to see a bigger collapse before they figured it out.
Well, this is what you're seeing. People cut the cord because there was an oversaturation of media and people realized that the cable bills were so high and you weren't watching 95% of those channels. So now what all of these streamers did was they had a very approachable price point. People were saving money. You've now, in some cases, doubled the price that you were charging only just 2 years ago. And with inflation and the economy and people having less disposable income, they're going to start making those deep cuts. And I think that this is reactionary. But I'm telling you right now, I'm not buying it.
What bothers me most is that they're going to have more content on the platform.
Well, they haven't said.
No, I'm not talking about new content. This is my concern. They're bolstering their back catalog so that it looks like there's so much on this app and you're going to want to subscribe, but they are still going to put less and less into production to save a buck, which is what's happening now. So if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go spiral about my future.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this and every week on Monoreal Radio. Monoreal Radio will always be free for now. But there are many ways that you can help support the show. Please give us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Join the conversation on social media at Monoreal Radio. On all major platforms, share your favorite episodes with family and friends who may enjoy them. And of course, and please, based on this reaction, book your next trip with Jackie. Links to everything can be found at monorealradio.com. We all get one story. Make yours a magical one.
On behalf of Monoreal Radio, we'd like to thank you for joining us. We'll see you at the movies, the stuff dreams are made of.